It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday with foods that researchers say could lead to a longer, healthier life, but still taste good. First, a new investigative report takes a look at Wisconsin's emergency mental health care system. In Wisconsin, each county is responsible for deciding how to handle psychiatric emergencies, a system that often relies on law enforcement to deal with people having mental health crises, especially in rural parts of the state. There's just one state-run psychiatric hospital open to the public in the entire state of Wisconsin, meaning that patients sometimes have to be transported hours before getting care. The Joint Finance Committee has appropriated $10 million to build more crisis centers around the state, but that funding is currently stuck in a budget dispute. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this part of your life? Have you or a loved one experienced a mental health crisis? Have you been through the state system? What was your experience like? If you're a first responder, love to hear from you as well. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Erin McGrody is an investigative reporting intern at Wisconsin Watch. I talked to her yesterday about her reporting on Wisconsin's emergency psychiatric care system. Now, here in Wisconsin, you write, counties are in charge. They're responsible for figuring out their crisis mental health care. In practice, how does that work?
As it currently stands, you know, more populous counties like Dane and like Milwaukee are able to have full-fledged mental health emergency rooms and emergency resources for its residents. But in smaller counties like Superior, for example, where one of my sources is from, they don't have any resources, no continuum of care, as a lot of experts have referred to it. So most people experiencing mental health crises have to be transported hours across the state, typically by law enforcement, to go to Winnebago Mental Health Institute.
Yeah, I would imagine that there would be multiple places around the state that might be able to take in somebody in that situation, an emergency mental health care situation. Why do so many counties count on this one facility in Winnebago County?
So Winnebago Mental Health Institute is one of two state-funded mental health institutes. The other is Mendota, here just outside of Madison. But that institute is largely reserved for people going through the criminal legal system. So if you are an individual experiencing a mental health crisis in a less populous, more rural county, then Winnebago is essentially your only option.
Wisconsin does things a little differently. Can you talk a little bit about what neighboring states are doing that gives at least a little more, if not local, regional option for people in this situation?
Yeah, so Wisconsin is one of the few states in the Midwest, actually, that still rely on counties to handle their own emergency mental health services. Most surrounding states have regionalized mental health crisis models, which means that the state is split up into regions and the counties within those regions can kind of pool resources and create emergency mental health access for residents of those counties within that specific region. So Iowa, for example, has a regionalized model, as does Minnesota and Missouri.
In just a few minutes, we'll talk to one of the people you talked to, Chrissy Bernard, who's been through this situation. In general, especially for someone in a rural county, what does this lack of local treatment, lack of even regional treatment, mean for them?
Well, it means that if they are in crisis, typically the person or people who respond are police officers. Now, this can be difficult for the person in crisis as well as the officers, because most police officers don't have in-depth training on how to handle a situation where an individual is going through a mental health crisis. Because of that lack of training, there's the potential for police presence to escalate the person in crisis. In Barnard's situation, she was experiencing crisis. The police were the only ones able to respond, and she was transported to Winnebago Mental Health Institute handcuffed in the back of a patrol car, which is not the most therapeutic way to enter inpatient psychiatric care.
Talking to Aaron McGroarty with Wisconsin Watch, looking at reporting on Wisconsin's psychiatric crisis response system and gaps in that system. Aaron, a lot of people, it sounds like, according to your reporting, are looking for changes, state politicians, the governor, attorney general, and others. What kind of changes are they looking for?
Yeah, so the attorney general organized a task force a few years ago to look at this issue and bring together a variety of voices to come up with ideas. This included mental health practitioners, social work advocates, a lot of law enforcement who, you know, acknowledge that they don't have adequate training for these situations. Not only that, but in smaller counties where maybe only a few officers are on shift at a time, if one officer has to transport a mental health patient 5 hours away, that takes that officer off of shift. And in turn, there's, you know, less public safety resources for that individual community.
And $10 million were set aside in a past budget to do at least some of this work, but what? It's stuck?
Yeah, so the governor had proposed about $12.3 million over 2 years to build up regional crisis centers. These would act as stabilization facilities for people experiencing mental health crises. That way they wouldn't have to be transported all the way across the state. They could be treated closer to their home community, closer to family and friends and a support system. The governor's funding did not make it through the legislative process. The Joint Finance Committee ultimately took all of the governor's proposals out of the budget and set aside $10 million in supplemental funding. But the way that state statute works is that an agency designated to receive supplemental funding has to meet with the Joint Finance Committee and essentially justify that they need the funding. As it currently stands, there's a bit of a standstill between the Joint Finance Committee and the Department of Health Services. So this funding is essentially sitting there. And if it's not sorted out, then it will lapse back into the general fund.
Another piece of the puzzle here, we're talking about crisis facilities. You write a little bit about, you know, what happens next. Is there another level of treatment? You use the phrase, I think, continuum of care earlier, so that it's not you're in the crisis center or you're getting nothing. Do we have things in between?
So, like I mentioned, in more populous areas, there are absolutely, in between levels. Madison, for example, UW Hospital has a 20-bed inpatient psychiatric care unit. This can operate for individuals who are admitted to the ER in crisis, and they can stay there from anywhere from, 3 or 4 days to longer if necessary. One of my sources, who's head of emergency psychiatric services for Milwaukee, Dr. Tony Thrasher, mentioned that a lot of times individuals in crisis can stabilize within 24, 48, or 72 hours. So those longer 90-day holds that are standard practice at Winnebago Institute are oftentimes not necessary.
Another part of this, you mentioned often police are the only available first responder in a mental health care crisis. You write that bigger cities like Madison and Milwaukee, and we've seen this around the country, started to train civilians to address at least some of these mental health crisis situations. What's happening so far?
Yeah, so in Madison, they have the Community Alternative Response Emergency Services, or CARES, program, and they recently released a report this past November, kind of cataloging their responses and their work over the last year to identify whether the program's working. And they responded to 935 calls in its first year of operation and were able to resolve most of those situations on the scene without having to involve police officers. It looks like just 3% of those calls needed to be ultimately dispatched to law enforcement. So in these situations, we have people who are more trained, more adequately trained in mental health response, whether those are therapists, social workers, any number of people, crisis workers who can respond to a crisis situation and ultimately de-escalate it without having to require law enforcement, which works better for the patient who may not want to interact with law enforcement. And ultimately, it works better for law enforcement who aren't getting adequate training on how to handle these situations.
Erin, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks so much.
That was Erin McGroarty with Wisconsin Watch. She talked to us about her reporting on Wisconsin's psychiatric crisis response system. Coming up, we'll meet one of the people featured in her report, a resident of Superior who's experienced that system firsthand and now works as a peer support specialist. You can join in if you have a story you're willing to share at 800-642-1234. If you or a loved one has dealt with Wisconsin's emergency mental health system, such as it is, what happened? How did it go? Do you work at some point in this field as a first responder or a service provider? You could join in as well at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up that conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation about Wisconsin's emergency psychiatric care system, which advocates say relies too much on law enforcement, can be traumatizing for patients. Our next guest has experienced that system firsthand and now works to help other people in that situation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your own experiences. Chrissy Barnard is a peer support specialist with the National Alliance on Mental Illness in Wisconsin, also known as NAMI Wisconsin, and president of the NAMI Lake Superior South Shore affiliate. Chrissy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, we just heard from Erin some of the big picture going on here. You shared your story with her some. Can you tell us a little bit about the situation you found yourself in I think 15 years ago or so?
Yeah, so my mental health struggles started at a young age and then only grew worse over time. And I actually have had 33 hospitalizations. And in 2007, it really peaked, and I was in and out of the hospital every month, but the month of August. And January, I was eventually committed to Winnebago. And getting handcuffed by the police and hauled across the state is very, very traumatizing. And that was an eye-opening experience for me. And I've been at several different hospitals across Wisconsin and in Minnesota. And Winnebago, I was there from January through the end of May, and it caused me so much hardship because I ended up losing a fiance, a house that we had together, my job and friends, relationships, and my pets and everything. And it destroyed almost my entire life. And I felt like I lost my soul and who I was in the process. So it was definitely a game changer for me.
So much going on there. Part of the problem is the sheer distance. You're from Superior, Winnebago. Yeah. That's in Appleton. How much did that, just being transported back and forth and then being so far away from home, how much did the sheer distance add to your problems?
Well, it adds a great deal of difficulty because my family couldn't come and visit me because it was winter and it's a 5-hour drive. Almost 5 hours. And so I felt even more isolated than other people may have been. So it was a challenge for sure.
Now you're working with other people as a peer support specialist. Can you talk about some of what helped you get past that situation where you were, as you were saying, in and out of hospitals?
Yeah. So what really helped change things for me was a therapy called dialectical behavioral therapy, and then getting peer support through NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and medications also helped for me. And the peer support was really a game changer with that, having that trifecta with those three. And it changed my life completely. I moved back to Superior after my Winnebago stay. And I was able to get a job. I've had the same job almost 13 years now. I have multiple jobs now in addition to the peer support. And then I bought my own house and straightened out my finances. And I have a dog and two cats. And I'm involved with NAMI at all different levels, including at the national level now. And I also feel like I can give back to my community. And working as a peer support specialist, I now give hope to others that recovery is possible and encourage them to find the supports they need to find their own journey to recovery.
With the emergency mental health crisis system in Wisconsin, not much has changed, as I understand it, in the last 15 years. What kind of changes would you like to see? So maybe that person going through what you went through today gets help faster, gets better help in the moment.
Yes, I would like it to see a more regionalized model, not so county by county based, because I've seen the differences living in different parts of this state, that it's variable, greatly variable. Some counties have way more resources than other counties. And like, for example, Douglas County is like one of the only counties without CCS. So it would be great to see more consistency across the whole state.
And I'm sorry, so CCS is?
Comprehensive Community Services.
Thank you.
And so it would be great to have a regional-based model where there would be more services provided in each area of the state. So,
talking to Chrissy Barnard, peer support specialist with NAMI Wisconsin. That's the National Alliance on Mental Illness here in Wisconsin. She's based in Superior, talking about her own experiences and changes she'd like to see in Wisconsin's mental health care crisis system. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Brad is with us in Milwaukee. Brad, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I've been a psychiatric nurse for 11 years. I worked at all of the major psychiatric hospitals in the city of Milwaukee. And I started at county, which back in the day, they would have wrist and ankle restraints. Federal government came in and they said that was enough. There was restraint beds. So people were put into restraints. You have this thing, it's called catecholamine collapse. And people, they get their adrenaline worked up. You put them in a restraint bed, and then they relax, and all kinds of really bad things happen, like heart attack, stroke, things of that nature. Then I moved on to another psychiatric hospital. They were doing the same thing, and then I found a hospital that has a complete shift in how they treat human beings without having to use restraint beds, without having to use IM psychotropic meds to control the behaviors. However, there's issues with that in that you will get a certain level, higher level of acuity, where the training, even amongst psychiatric nurses, isn't quite up there to keep people safe. So the issue is very complex to find people care. That's another thing as far as insurance goes, you know,
Brad, I got you. We don't have a ton of time. You've already given us a lot to talk about. I think, Chrissy, Brad concerned about, the quality of care, the humaneness of care, staffing, availability of care to people who need it. Run where you want to go with that.
Wow, there's just so much in there. Well, I know the access to care is a huge barrier across the state, and with the and there's a lack of providers across the state, and there's also the issue of getting credentialing from the state as well. So I know for our area in particular, in northwestern Wisconsin, we have to get services in Minnesota usually because we don't have any inpatient beds in the very far northwest region. And that creates a whole bunch of issues because a lot of people, a lot of my friends end up in Fargo, North Dakota. So then the state loses their jurisdiction. They end up in Rochester, Minnesota. And so we end up all over the state. I've ended up in Cambridge, Minnesota. And it creates all sorts of barriers, because then you have even less access to your family. You have less access to the financial resources you need and transportation to get back home. It's just a nightmare sometimes. And that access is a barrier everywhere in the state. But I notice that it has a unique challenge for those border counties in particular, everywhere along the border counties. So yeah, there's so much in that comment. It's just wonderful,
Brad,
to hear.
Thanks for that call. Chrissy, in our last minute or so, I know you've been advocating for more regional care so people can get care within, you know, an hour of their home instead of in North Dakota or at Appleton or whatever the case may be. Are the people who are making decisions, do you think they're hearing you? Are you seeing this being taken seriously?
Well, I feel the governor is. I'm not so sure at other levels of the government. So I do hope that changes are being made and will be made over time. But I'd pray for better changes that are faster, because we need change now. Our system's in crisis.
Chrissy, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Chrissy Barnard is a peer support specialist with the National Alliance on Mental Illness Wisconsin, also known as NAMI, and president of the NAMI Lake Superior South Shore affiliate. She talked to us about her advocacy for crisis mental health care changes here in Wisconsin. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll get delicious recipes inspired by some of the healthiest places on the planet, where the food seems to have long-term benefits for our well-being. Find out more with the author of the cookbook, Blue Zone's American Kitchen, 100 Recipes to Live to 100. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin Democratic Representative Mark Pocan talks about new bills in Congress he says will protect Social Security and Medicare programs from potential spending cuts in the new Congress. Now it's Food Friday. Our next guest has traveled the world looking at some of the healthiest places on the planet, the Blue Zones, where people live longer and healthier lives. And part of the story is the food that they eat. In his new cookbook, he's sharing delicious recipes inspired by some of those healthy cultures with ingredients available here in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions about what makes for healthy eating, the cultures that seem to do well by their food. If you've been following this Blue Zone story over the years, what do you think about the idea? Do you have questions about our guests' travels and research? And is there a food that you eat for health? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Dan Buettner is a National Geographic explorer and New York Times bestselling author of the Blue Zone books. His newest book is The Blue Zone's American Kitchen, 100 Recipes to Live to 100. Dan, thanks for joining us today.
It's a delight to be here.
For people who haven't encountered the Blue Zone idea in the past, Dan, give us the basics. What do we mean by a Blue Zone?
Well, I set out to, in a sense, reverse engineer longevity. So instead of looking for answers in a test tube or in a Petri dish, working with National Geographic and a team of demographers, we found the statistically longest lived pockets around the world where people are making it to age mid-90s, even 100 at the highest proportions. That means they're not dying of the chronic disease killing Americans. And because only 20% of how long you live is dictated by your genes, the other 80% is something else, in finding these places, somewhere in there, there's a secret to living longer, and I've been studying that for 20 years.
We're going to focus most of our conversation today on the food, but What are some of the other key things that we can reach out and take advantage of to increase our healthy lifespan?
So the longest lived areas are Sardinia, Italy, Nicoya, Costa Rica, Icaria, Greece, Okinawa, Japan, and among the Seventh-day Adventists. And the big insight is that these people don't try to live longer. America, we have, it's an idea largely marketed to us that the path to health, weight loss, and longevity is to find a program, whether it's a diet or an exercise program or a supplement regimen, get on it and stick to it. But the reality with each of those three, they are occasionally short-term successes and always long-term failures. The key insight for Blue Zones is that these people are eating better, moving more, socializing more, living with purpose as a result of their environment. So if you want a healthier household or a healthier city, the secret is to change the environment, change the nudges and the defaults. So that's, I would say, the overarching idea.
When it comes to food, in the new book, you write there is an overarching idea that, you know, the specifics may look different from culture to culture, but there are some common things about their diets that really seem to pay off. What are those common elements?
So if you want to know what a 100-year-old ate to live to be 100, you can't just ask them or her what you've been eating lately because they don't remember. They don't remember their life. So to get at it, my team and I found 155 dietary surveys done in the past, over the past 100 years in all five Blue Zones. And I did this under the aegis of Harvard University's Walter Willett. And we did what's called a meta-analysis, which essentially is we averaged. And we see that the dietary pattern in every place in the world that are producing long-lived people, they're eating 90 to 98% whole food plant-based. It's a high carbohydrate diet, which shocks people. But we're not talking about simple carbs like donuts and sodas and crackers and chips. We're talking whole grains, greens, nuts, tubers like sweet potato, and the cornerstone of every longevity diet in the world is beans. In fact, if you're eating about a cup of beans a day, that's probably worth an extra 4 years of life expectancy over getting protein from less healthy sources. They do eat some meat, but only about five times per month on average, very little fish. No cow's dairy, which I know is an inconvenient message for Wisconsin. And by the way, I spend my summers in Wisconsin, so you know, I have some familiarity. My neighbors probably don't appreciate me saying that. And then what they drink is 6 glasses of water, herbal teas, good news for most of us, coffee, almost in all Blue Zones, and then a little bit of wine, usually with meals. So that seems to be the dietary pattern that produces the healthiest human beings.
Talking to Dan Buettner with National Geographic. His new book is The Blue Zones American Kitchen, 100 Recipes to Live to 100. You can find a few recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday, and you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you changed your diet in the interest of health? Were you able to stick to those changes? And did you do some of what our guest talked about, especially more plant-based food, more whole foods? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You mentioned beans, and you shared, one of the recipes you shared is a bean recipe, Mohawk baked beans. Can you tell us a little bit about this one?
Yeah, so this is in Blue Zone American Kitchen. So I wanted recipes that would easily resonate with Americans. And pork and beans is, you know, we've been around for generations. And Mohawk beans is a Native American take on that, that uses, there's no animal products in it, a beautiful pinto bean or red beans, a little bit of maple syrup for sweetener, just a little bit, a few spices, but it is a healthy version of the unhealthy staple we're used to. And actually an Apache chef named David Smoke Mikulski made it for us. And a great example, I think, of a Native American ingenuity. And by the way, beans were a cornerstone of the Native American diet, especially in the South. You know, up where we're from, there's more kind of wild rice. But you get in the South and the East, Native Americans were very much fueled by beans.
Now, you mentioned your Wisconsin connection, and you talked to a lot of people around the country, including a couple stops in Wisconsin, a couple of people who have been on a Food Friday in the past. Ya Van, a Hmong chef who was a refugee, grew up in Wisconsin. I've been to his restaurant in Minneapolis. I'm happy to say you went out with Ya Van and his mom, I believe, foraging. There's a picture of that in the book. Can you talk a little bit about what you learned there?
Yeah, so, you know, the idea here, I didn't set out to explore any ethnicity. I spent 150 hours at NYU at the archives with another researcher, and we found dietary surveys done in America in search of these patterns, these dietary patterns, which we know lead longevity. And we found it among Native Americans, African Americans, Latinos, and Asian Americans. So he is a mother, a Hmong refugee. She took us into the field, and she showed us how she harvests her food, and she made it. And she contributes a couple recipes here. You know, they were eating mostly plant-based. Of course, you know, they transport them from Cambodia to St. Paul or, you know, Wisconsin, where there's a lot more meat and cheese. They eat more of it. But the point is, the way they traditionally ate was mostly plant-based. And she... the most delicious hot sauce I've ever eaten in my life. She pulled the ingredients out of her garden. I remember there was garlic, there was peppers and lemongrass, and she pounded them all together right in front of our eyes. It took her about 3 minutes to make this. And, you know, it was one of these hot sauces where you cry tears of joy. And, you know, far better than we'd spend $8.99 for a little bottle of. And, you know, it's probably 50 cents worth of ingredients and, you know, all the natural goodness.
And you also talked to Alan Burgo, who's been on the show. You went foraging with him. I think that was on land here in Wisconsin. What did you learn from that experience?
It was, yeah. Pilar Gerasimo's land. So, you know, he very much learned directly and indirectly from the Native Americans. And you know, we would look at a patch of Wisconsin forest and see sort of, well, I got to get through that so I can get to the restaurant. And he looks at it as a full meal. So he was harvesting chestnuts and sorrel, which is a beautiful green that grew naturally, a plethora of different mushrooms. And, you know, he spent maybe, I don't know, an hour and a half for foraging, and he came out with a 5-course dinner. NBC Today show joined me there and covered him, and he's just a genius, and you know, yet another manifestation. There's so much culinary genius right under our noses, yet we end up at TGIF's or you know, Pizza Hut for our dinners. And I really tried to harvest the American genius in all American states, but really in the service of bringing to life this diet that we know produces healthy Americans.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Stephanie is with us in Milwaukee. Stephanie, hi.
Hi. I had a question based on the speaker's research that he's done so far. I was curious about if there's been any meaningful connections drawn between the diets of people in like the blue zones and related to glycemic index and glycemic load. I mention that because, like, in the U.S., I know there's a bit of a problem with, like, the American diet and foods causing a lot of, like, spikes in blood sugar and chronic diseases as a result.
Stephanie, thanks for that call. And, Dan, you were talking about diets, healthier diets being lower in the sugars and the simple carbohydrates. Is that is the glycemic index part of the dots we connect there?
Yeah, Stephanie brings up a really good point. So the average American consumes between 22 and 24 added teaspoons of sugar every day. And that same, what she's talking about, glycemic is a measure of how much it spikes your blood sugar. And obviously the spikes in the American diet largely come from sugars and the simple carbohydrates. In blue zones, they're only consuming about 7 to 8 added teaspoons of sugar a day. And the carbohydrates, they're by and large consuming are complex carbohydrates. And by the way, one of the easiest ways to lower the glycemic load of whatever meal you're eating is, one, eat a portion of beans with it. We know that's going to lower the glycemic load of the entire meal. And here's the other great secret. A true sourdough bread, leavened with basically a slow rise sourdough bread leavened with lactobacillus, that actually lowers the glycemic load of a meal too. Well, plain old white bread will spike it, but a true sourdough will actually lower it. So this diet that we captured, remember, this isn't invented by some doctor in South Beach. This has evolved slowly over hundreds of years, sometimes millennia. And the reason these diets survive is because they're favoring the people. They're favoring the health. And also, by the way, they taste delicious. So, you know, following one of these recipes, you're basically consuming centuries of wisdom.
Stephanie, thanks for that. Oh, go ahead, Dan.
No, I'm done.
Stephanie, thanks for the call. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Dan Buettner about his most recent book, The Blue Zones, American Kitchen, 100 Recipes to Live to 100. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you made efforts to change your diet, cut back on the sugar and simple carbs, for example, cook with more whole foods, more plant-based diet? How has it worked for you? Do you feel like something's missing or has it been great? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Dan Buettner about his most recent book. It's called The Blue Zones, American Kitchen, 100 Recipes to Live to 100. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question about Dan's work on Blue Zones and the foods that people eat in these healthy, long-lived places, if you've made some choices, some adaptations in your diet with an eye toward health and well-being in the long term, call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Dan, I want to check out another recipe you shared with us. An ingredient very often abundant here in Wisconsin, zucchini. These are Mama's zucchini pupusas. Can you give us the story behind these guys?
Well, the Salvadorans came over here, and they were seeing a lot of their clients getting sick, suffering from obesity and diabetes. And the daughter of the original the mother realized that, took some classes and found that eating plant-based lowers your chances of obesity, lowers your chances of diabetes, and in a very sort of meat-forward cuisine these days, Salvadoran, she found plant-based analogs to it. You know that if you, I draw a lot of my research from something called the Adventist Health Study, which followed 103,000 Americans for over 20 years. And it found that the people dying the quickest, the shortest life expectancy, were the meat eaters. Somewhere in between were the egg and dairy consumers, and the longest lived people were the pescatarians, or people who are vegan plus fish, or the vegan. And the interesting thing about it, and remember, we're talking over 100,000 people, the people who were just vegan or ate vegan plus fish weighed 20 pounds less than the meat eaters. So one of the easiest ways to lose weight is to just go whole food, plant-based, rather than these newfangled diets and, you know, Weight Watchers, et cetera.
Let's go back to our callers. Christina is with us in Glenwood City. Christina, hello.
Hi there. Thank you. I've got two questions. I'm wondering, do they do much fermentation? And also, if they were going to have a treat, what might that be?
Interesting, Christina. Let's start with fermentation. I like fermented stuff, Dan. Is that a big part of Blue Zone cultures?
Yes. Yes. You'll see frequently pickles. You see in Okinawa, especially the misos, the fermentation of soy especially. So that does figure in. Probably not as much as you think, though. Mm-hmm. And as far as treating, yes, they do treat themselves. You know, after church on Sunday or a wedding or a birthday or, you know, a special occasion, they're, you know, they eat meat during special occasions. And they all have these sort of signature sweets and they're delicious. But where we get in trouble You know, we start our day with pancake and syrup or a muffin, which is essentially cake. And, you know, we have dessert and after dinner, and we have cookies as a snack, and we don't realize that we're over-treating ourselves. So my point being is there is a place, and we should all be able to treat ourselves occasionally.
Christina, thanks a lot for the call. It's our colleagues over at Public TV know this. Cookie Monster calls them sometimes foods, and I got to admit, in my life, sometimes foods end up being daily foods. That's pretty common in the American diet and sounds like pretty uncommon in the Blue Zone cultures.
That's right. And it's largely because in Blue Zone cultures, the cheapest, most accessible, and tastiest foods tend to be whole food plant-based. You know, these delicious soups and stews and sort of hearty. Whereas the cheapest and most accessible food in our food environment are burgers and chips and fries and sodas and candy bars. And, you know, for my main job for the past 14 years, and we worked with Marshall, Wisconsin, we've worked at changing the environment of entire cities. So all of the onus of trying to eat healthy isn't just on individuals. You shape the environment so healthy foods are more accessible and cheaper than the junk food, and you see BMI drop in every case.
We're talking to Dan Buettner about his new book, The Blue Zones, American Kitchen, 100 Recipes to Live to 100. We've got three of those recipes online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Dan, can you share some ideas maybe for this weekend, some easy little things we can do to start building the habits of Blue Zone style eating?
Yes. So the most important ingredient in any longevity recipe is taste. I could tell you fermented tofu or bitter melon or walnuts or broccoli are the healthiest food, but if you don't like them, you're not going to eat them. This weekend, you want to live longer, eat healthier, lose weight, get your hands on a whole food plant-based book, page through it with your family, pick a half a dozen recipes that you think your family would like, and cook the first two or three this Saturday or Sunday. Most of the recipes in the Blue Zone American Cooking Kitchen are one-pot meals. And until you, A, know how to cook it, B, you know you can afford the ingredients, and C, your family likes it, it's not going to become a habit. And once you find something that you think tastes delicious, my job is over. It doesn't require willpower. It doesn't require, individual responsibility. It's just, wait, that really tastes good. I'm going back to eat some more of it.
I've got to ask, Dan, you've literally been around the world meeting with people with these cultures and eating these foods. What are some of the things that have been your favorites, either when somebody else makes them for you or that you've brought home to your own kitchen?
Every single day, I have a Sardinian minestrone. I met the longest lived family in history. They're in the Guinness Book of World Records. 9 siblings, collective age, 841 years. Every day of their life, they made a 3-bean minestrone with tomatoes and onions, lettuce, celery, carrots, you know, slow cook, but it's savory. It's got all the fiber necessary for your microbiome, all kinds of micronutrients. I start my day with that every day. And I think that's probably been the most important thing I learned. The other thing, a very simple longevity food, accessible to everybody listening right now, sweet potato. You get a sweet potato, you wrap it with paper towel, get the paper towel wet, throw it in the microwave for a few minutes. You basically have one of the best longevity meals, and they're delicious. They'll shock you. And there's a couple ideas right there.
Dan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It was a delight, and may you all eat to 100.
That's Dan Buettner. He joined us for Food Friday to talk about his latest book. It's called The Blue Zones American Kitchen, 100 Recipes to Live to 100. If you go over to WPR.org/Food Friday, you'll find our note about that, links to a few recipes from the book. They all sound really good, and information about the book itself. And let us know if you make those recipes, how they went. Send us a note, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, one of the frontiers of biomedical science these days is a quest for neural implants to help tweak our brains, help us communicate, help us contact the outside world, including for people with conditions that make it tough for them to communicate with others. Find out what's going on. Check out some of the latest research out there and what's going on in actual hospitals around the country. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network.